From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Today at Pimlico, it's the 134th running of the Preakness Stakes, but will there be a 135th? Ahead on Only a Game, bankruptcy threatens to put the Triple Crown's second jewel in hock. Also, University of Vermont baseball says goodbye after a 118-year run, and NCAA President Dr. Miles Brand discusses the alarming rate at which collegiate athletic programs are being cut. Also ahead, how schoolchildren belonging to sailors in the Volvo Ocean Race benefit from a sea of knowledge and fathom a deep sense of community.
It is a circus, but it's a fun circus because it's a family. It's nice, and you're never alone. I say it's like camp. We sort of eat together, stay together, play together, and it's great fun. And you get to see the world.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Denver definitively dismissed Dallas. The harried Hawks looked hopeless against Cleveland, and now the Nuggets and the Cavaliers await the results of the two Game 7s set for tomorrow. Joining me now to discuss the NBA playoffs is Kevin Hench of Fox Sports. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here, Bill.
The Houston Rockets have lost their biggest stars, Tracy McGrady and Yao Ming, to injuries, and yet they have pushed the heavily favored Lakers to the brink with Game 7 scheduled for tomorrow afternoon in Los Angeles. How did the Rockets do it?
I think they've capitalized on some Laker indifference, some Laker softness, some Laker looking past them. And I wish that could continue for 48 more minutes, but I doubt the Laker crowd will allow them to lose at home in a Game 7 against a team that's playing seven guys, four of whom are journeymen.
Also in the Western Conference, the Denver Nuggets easily knocked off Dirk Nowitzki and the Dallas Mavericks 4-1. How much credit does new Nugget Chauncey Billups deserve for Denver's success?
All the credit in the world. Here's a guy who completely changed the culture in Denver, hometown hero, obviously. This is a great stat. In Carmelo Anthony's five previous playoff seasons without Chauncey Billups, he shot 38.9% from the floor, and the Nuggets got blown out in every series, going 4-20 over those five first-round flameouts. Since Billups arrived this year, Carmelo Anthony is shooting 48% from the floor, scoring 27 points a game, and the Nuggets are 8-2. So I think Mr. Big Shot definitely gives Denver a shot.
In 2006, the Mavericks went to the NBA Finals for the first time in franchise history. Then they failed to get out of the first round twice before this year's quick exit from the second round. Is it time for Dallas owner Mark Cuban to end the Nowitzki era and perhaps begin rebuilding?
Overdue. That rebuilding should have been taking place around Devin Harris, who now plays for the New Jersey Nets, while aging creaky point guard Jason Kidd earns $21 million a year for the Mavericks.
New Orleans and Dallas each managed only one win in the first and second round against Denver. The Nuggets will face the winner of the Lakers-Rockets series. How does Denver match up with those teams?
Well, the key for the Nuggets that makes them much better than they've been in years past is defense. They finished 29th in the league in defense with Marcus Camby last year. They got rid of a great defender in Marcus Camby and somehow improved 11 spots to 18th in the league this year. And I think a lot of that is due to the presence of the Birdman, Chris Anderson, who blocked, get this, per 48 minutes, he blocked 5.75 shots a game. Denver can get stops when they need it, and we know they can score. So I think Denver's a very scary team, and I don't know why no one's really talking about them, except for us, Bill.
In the Eastern Conference, the Magic and the Celtics are headed for Game 7 in Boston tomorrow night after the Magic won Game 6 in Orlando on Thursday. Between this season and last, the Celtics will have played 4 Game 7s at the TD Bank North Garden. They won all the other ones. Will they do it again?
I suspect the Celtics will win Game 7 tomorrow, but does it really matter? I mean, these two gladiators, the Magic and the Celtics, just pounding each other for 7 games, and the reward is you get thrown to the Lions. I mean, neither one of these teams can beat the Cavaliers, and I think they've kind of been proving that by taking turns showing that they don't want to play the Cavaliers. I mean, between the Magic's epic collapses in games 4 and 5 and then the Celtics playing so terribly in the fourth quarter of game 6, I'm not sure either of these teams wants to face LeBron. Ray Allen is shooting 30%. I don't know what happened to the Ray Allen that lit it up for 51 against the Bulls, because he has vanished. I mean, really, the only guy right now in that series that is fun to watch is Rajon Rondo, who is having one of the most amazing playoff seasons in NBA history.
Regarding the Cleveland Cavaliers, LeBron is very much still LeBron, but who are the most important members of his supporting cast that we ought to be paying attention to now?
Well, Mo Williams is a great addition, and that the whole point of acquiring Mo Williams was to relieve some of the scoring pressure on LeBron. He's a great perimeter shooter, but the thing that makes Cleveland so tough is their physical junkyard defense. Anderson Varejao, Zydrunas Ilgauskas, they're big. Ben Wallace coming off the bench, Joe Smith coming off the bench. Delonte West is a tough, hard-nosed defender, and they just come at you in wave after wave of physical team defense, which is why they're holding their opponents to 39.7% shooting in the playoffs. Teams do not get good shots against the Cavs, and they are going to be very hard to beat 4 times in the next 2 series.
Kevin, it seems evident to me that you do not wish to alter your prediction that Kobe and LeBron will face each other in the finals. Have I got that right?
You got that right. I believe Kobe and LeBron will play each other in the finals. However, the Lakers have made a liar out of me already, because I emphatically said that the Lakers would not lose 4 games during the entire Western Conference playoffs before getting to the finals. They've already lost 4 games, and assuming they win Game 7 tomorrow, we'll have a whole other series against the Nuggets, so they might lose 6 games before they get to the finals, but I do believe they will be there, where LeBron will be waiting.
Well, that was going to be my final question, because the Cleveland Cavaliers have had a much easier route so far in the postseason. Does this give them some sort of substantial advantage, assuming these two teams do meet in the finals?
2 years ago, I might have said yes, but after watching the Celtics slug it out in all those Game 7s last year, everyone thought the Lakers would be so fresh, and turns out the best athletes in the world, it doesn't really matter. I don't think it's a big advantage to have played fewer games come June.
Kevin Hench writes for Fox Sports and joins me from time to time to talk about the NBA. Kevin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
The ponies will race amongst Pimlico's black-eyed Susans today in the 134th running of the Preakness. The fate of the beleaguered track will be determined in bankruptcy court, leading track rats and pundits alike to wonder if the second jewel of the Triple Crown will live to twinkle much beyond today. Only a game, Sarah Richards reports.
You know,
I didn't find her, though.
It's a cool, sunny afternoon at the Pimlico Racetrack in downtown Baltimore. Ray Thielen is here with a couple of friends. They sit on folding chairs and look out at the long track in front of them. Jockeys with porcelain physiques parade tall, glistening horses toward the starting gate for today's next race.
I got to check these horses out.
Late scratch of the sixth race. Just in
hey, somebody
one,
told me the bigger butt they got, the faster
they
are.
They
well, he's got a big butt, and I guarantee you he ain't faster than that little one.
What number was that?
That was the number 4, see?
Oh, yeah. He's slow.
This track was originally built in 1870. It's gone through many renovations, but it looks outdated. It's been struggling for years, and everyone here knows it. Railbird Bill Klaus is a 68-year-old retiree who comes here all the time.
I've been here 368 times at least, maybe 10,000 times at the track. I've been coming for 40 years.
He thinks simulcast racing is a big reason Pimlico Racetrack is losing money.
When you used to come to a track, you spent your money at this track because you couldn't bet somewhere else. Now, when you're putting your money, part of your money at Churchill, certain races, and Calder and Arlington Park and this one and that one in the same time, well, they're losing money here. I mean, they get some, but it's not like it used to be. Racing ain't like it used to be.
You hear it over and over again. Racing isn't like it used to be. Most of the people here today could probably tell you what those good times were like.
It is one of the cathedrals of
horse racing. It is hallowed ground.
That's Alan Foreman. He's the general counsel for the Maryland Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association. He says he's an optimist, that Pimlico can be saved by modernization. It's just Pimlico and similar tracks were built for a bygone era.
They're basically dinosaurs. At the time that these racetracks were built, the only gambling that was legal in this country was you either went to Las Vegas or you went to the racetrack. There were no lotteries, there was no slot machine gaming in states. You didn't have online competition. You didn't pretty much have competition from other sports.
Foreman says Pimlico is perfect for the Preakness when 100,000 fans want to attend. But that's one day a year. A day, by the way, that pays for the rest of the year. But otherwise, Pimlico's grandstands aren't needed for the small crowds like today's. And that's just one reason current owner Magna Entertainment has been pushed to the limit. As part of its bankruptcy plan, it might sell the track and the rights to its big moneymaker, the Preakness. And that worries people like Mike Pons. Pons stands alongside a dirt track at his training center in Hyde's, Maryland. It's a beautiful farm settled amongst green, rolling hills. Helmeted jockeys work out their horses. Pons has worked with horses all his life. He estimates about 20,000 people work in the horse industry in Maryland. He says their future depends on getting slot machines and the Preakness remaining in Maryland.
If it leaves Maryland for good, we're in a heap of trouble. The horse business, wow, we no longer matter. We're insignificant. We no longer have a day of worldwide significance. It's as if the Super Bowl is played in Maryland every single year, and the economic impact is probably larger.
Last month, Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley said he would, if necessary, use eminent domain to gain control of both the Preakness and Pimlico. But no one knows how such a move would play out in the Delaware court where Magna's bankruptcy is being overseen. Doug Reed directs the racetrack industry program at the University of Arizona. He says in order to keep Pimlico and the Preakness, Magna Entertainment must sell some of the 10 racetracks it owns and change the way it does business.
They got to do what they're doing right now, is reorganize, be smaller, leaner, keep a couple of the best properties maybe, and try to make a go of it with those. I think they were, you know, riddled with debt. They had what I would call acquisition lust. They probably bought too much and spread too thin.
Reed says Pimlico's future depends on whether it can bring in a new generation of racing fans. Magna Entertainment hopes today's infield concert with ZZ Top will attract a wider audience. People like Mike Pons will be watching. After all, he says, both the Preakness and the track that hosts the second jewel of the Triple Crown are too important to give up on.
All the history we have, you know, Pimlico next to Saratoga is the oldest racetrack in the country, and every good horse in the last century, not just the last 10 years, has come through Maryland on its journey. You know, the great Curlin was here for the Preakness and won, and, you know, you can go on and on and on. But to walk away from all that is laughable.
For Only a Game, I'm Sarah Richards.
The despot's heel is on thy shore, Maryland, my Maryland. His touch is at thy temple door, Maryland.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. New Zealand has the world's greatest diversity of penguin species. Thus spoke Greg Anderson, Tourism New Zealand's regional manager. It was a short waddle from that realization to the creation of this month's Penguathalon, which will occur just outside Auckland. Penguins will compete in 5 events, including football, frisbee, surfing, swing ball, whatever that might be, and of course the always popular waddle races. Visitors who find the antics of the penguins insufficiently exciting can take part in their own penguin-inspired games. In that context, children will be encouraged to don giant penguin feet. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, NCAA President Miles Brand joins me to discuss the decision of many schools to drop collegiate sports programs. But first, the University of Vermont baseball team is visiting the State University of New York Binghamton for doubleheaders today and tomorrow as the Catamounts look to grab the fourth and final spot in the America East tournament. But as Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports from Burlington, Vermont, the team's players and coaches and fans have much more on their minds.
Now for your Catamounts. Leading off, playing center field, number 8, Mark Minkowski.
The University of Vermont baseball team played 2 against Bryant University at Centennial Field on Tuesday, the last regular season home games in UVM baseball's 118-year history. Beset by a budget shortfall and a tough economy, the school announced in February that it would cut women's softball and men's baseball, which has produced 10 major leaguers, some of whom played on World Series winners a century ago. Vermont isn't alone, as universities everywhere struggle with declining endowments, increasing financial aid requests, and in the case of many state institutions, vanishing tax revenues. Northern Iowa University is also cutting baseball after this year, and the University of Massachusetts is considering it. And while the Massachusetts Institute of Technology is holding fast to the national pastime, it recently decided to eliminate 8 other sports. UVM President Daniel Fogel says that his school is casting its athletic lot with its nationally ranked skiing and men's hockey programs, and those that show similar promise.
We have competitive aspirations to win national championships in hockey and in skiing, and we want to be nationally competitive in men's and women's basketball, men's and women's soccer, and men's and women's lacrosse.
The final strike against UVM baseball, according to the school's athletic director Robert Corin, was the growth over the past 2 decades of the NCAA Division I baseball season to more than 50 games. That didn't square with Vermont's notoriously late springs.
While that works for schools in the South, they don't have to travel to get good weather to play 54 games. Everyone else does, and that's pushed up costs, travel time, all of those things. And you know, I think we played our first 20-some games on the road before we had a home game. And those games were primarily in the South. The unfortunate thing is, when the good weather arrives in Vermont for baseball, our season is over.
Bob Currier, a UVM baseball alumnus, has coached the Catamounts for the past 22 years. The first 18 of them without any baseball scholarships. Currier has led them to a 482-467 record. Today, he hoists a large hose to wet down the infield dirt, throws pregame batting practice, and even rousts his players from the locker room for UVM baseball's last team photograph.
10 minutes. Guys, team picture at 2 o'clock. White top, green hat.
Currier also has taken extra pains to keep his players focused on the present season.
Our guys, when they come to the clubhouse and on the field, that's the fun part. That's the part they enjoy, and we've tried to keep it that way and keep the distractions of other coaches recruiting them and calling them and trying to get them to visit, traveling to these schools and touring the schools and missing practice and getting back here for games. And we're loaded with freshmen sophomores this year. So it was certainly crushing to them and difficult for them to deal with it because they just went through a recruiting process and put their heart and soul into this place and believe they all made the right decisions, and we did. And then to have it just taken away by a third party was disheartening to them.
The 800-pound gorilla in the outfield has been the fact that this is the last year for UVM baseball. After losing their first 11 games, the Catamounts have clawed their way back to 19-30, including 6 straight conference wins.
The shortstop, number 13, Matt Duffy.
For Tuesday's final home games, fewer than 200 fans spread out in the sunny bleachers of Centennial Field, which opened in 1906. The outfield is surrounded by a colorful mix of billboards. More compelling on this day were the signs in the stands, a poster declaring UVM students want baseball to stay, and white and green T-shirts proclaiming, "I was there for the end of an era." This year's Vermont star, sophomore shortstop Matt Duffy, who homered in his first at-bat against Bryant, will be taking his team-leading .400 batting average and his 12 home runs to the big-time Division I program at the University of Tennessee. Many of his teammates are trying to transfer to schools that still carry baseball. Some, like sophomore pitcher Owen Ozanich from nearby South Burlington, are hanging up their spikes.
I'm also doing a semester abroad in France next year, so I figured it was maybe time to focus on life after baseball. And UVM is close by. It's a good school. I came here as a student first, and I walked onto the baseball team, so I figured this was probably my best option was to stay here.
While some here say they understand the economic reality, UVM alumnus and former pitcher Kirk McCaskill, who went on to win 110 games with the California Angels and the Chicago White Sox, doesn't agree with the decision to drop baseball.
I think it's mostly about the opportunity for the baseball players in the state of Vermont to have an opportunity to play Division I baseball. And I know Bill did a great job of kind of recruiting the Vermont kids first. And, you know, I think it's just a real big loss. I think it's a bad decision.
Senior co-captain Keith Rakes, who graduates tomorrow, says that even though he was able to complete his baseball career here, he's been robbed of a legacy.
I'm very disappointed. I mean, I can't take my kids to the game. I can't, you know, it's hard to say, you know, oh, I played baseball at Vermont, and, you know, they're going to be like, they don't have a program. I don't have anything to fall back on, you know, when I come back here, and, you know, it's just tough. It's a tough situation for everybody.
For last weekend's home games against the University of Maryland Baltimore County, UVM graduate and former team captain Rob Dietzel organized a reunion of fellow baseball alumni to show support for this year's team. They also took comfort in the memory that the school dropped the baseball team during the 1970s and reinstated it 7 years later.
Talking to a lot of the players, you know, we thought about it and said, hey, it's been done before, so perhaps it could happen again. Not sure when that might be, but if times are good again and a few of us can, you know, make some more money and donate to the program, you know, who knows?
The season-ending four-game series this weekend against Binghamton will determine if the Catamounts get to the postseason and extend their existence beyond tomorrow. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
UVM's baseball program isn't the only NCAA sport to be cut this season. Budgets are being crunched all across academia, and sports teams are feeling the squeeze. Even MIT, which had sponsored more Division III sports than any other school, recently dropped 8 sports from its roster of 41, including alpine skiing, men's and women's ice hockey, and gymnastics. Joining me now on the line is Miles Brand, president of the NCAA. Mr. Brand, welcome back to Only a Game.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Although individual programs have been dropped over the years, total participation in the NCAA reached a record of more than 17,000 teams and 412,000 athletes in 2007-2008. But this year, those numbers have dropped. Next year, they're expected to drop further. Did you anticipate those developments?
We suspected they were going to come. The financial situation that's facing our universities is really going to affect the athletic teams as well as the rest of the campus. And that is going to involve the dropping of some what we call non-revenue sports other than football and men's basketball.
A few athletic departments are still doing just fine, especially those with large TV deals. Both Arkansas and South Carolina have agreed to send $1 million from their athletic revenue to help cover budget shortfalls on the academic side. Is this a good precedent?
Well, to the extent that athletics can help academics, it's always a good precedent. But there are certain conferences that have strong TV deals, as you point out, that enable them to have a revenue stream that allows them to move forward, even though the economy is not very good. That's a minority, a small minority of all our universities, though.
Well, as you suggest, most athletic departments are subsidized by the universities. Of the 120 bowl-eligible football programs, only about 24 receive no financial help from their schools. Some programs are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars traveling across the country to play teams in their own conference. Back in the day, conferences were based on geography in order to avoid exactly this sort of travel problem. Is there any way to turn the clock back in that respect?
You know, there really isn't a way to turn the clock back. The conferences come together not just for geographic reasons, but they come together to increase competition and to work with like universities, universities that share their academic values. So I think we're kind of stuck with that.
Are there other ways in which universities can reduce their expenses and perhaps save teams?
Well, that's a very important question. You have to first ask yourself, why do universities have athletic teams at all? It seems like an anomalous situation in which a higher education institution is supporting sports. And the reason for that is participation in college sports adds value to their education. And if that's the case, the more that participate, the more teams we have, the better off we are serving the purposes of college sports. So you have to look for other ways besides cutting teams in which to save that crucial value. One way to do it, I think, is to look at the number of support troops you have. Obviously, you need coaches, you need academic advisors, but I think a lot of our teams right now are spending money on support troops that maybe they don't need as much. Maybe they're putting too much energy and time into off-season play. Maybe they're investing too much in their new arenas and their new stadiums. We have to look for other ways than besides cutting teams.
You realize, of course, as you say this, that the 60 or 70 assistant football coaches at Michigan and Ohio State are shaking their fists at the radio.
Well, I think institutions have to decide what's important to them. Is it the participation of young people in the game that matters the most? And if so, then I think we should do everything in our power to make sure that the costs of running our athletic programs are within reason.
Has your office had any trouble keeping track of the statistics as teams have fallen away because the universities have had to, look at their budgets more closely?
No, I don't think so. You know, even though we're seeing some cuts and they're all very painful, the number of the cuts is really very low. Over the last 3 years, only about 160 teams have been dropped. But at the same time, about 200 have been added. So the numbers really aren't very large. They're painful in each and every case, but at least to the current time, the numbers aren't that large.
Cuts to men's wrestling, which began in the wake of Title IX reforms, are continuing. At least three programs disappeared in the month of April alone, and at least eight programs have been cut over the course of this season. The National Wrestling Coaches Association says there are 260,000 high school wrestlers in the U.S., but only 260 wrestling programs at four-year colleges. That can't be a statistic that you like to hear.
Yeah, actually, it's not a statistic I'd like to hear. Wrestling is a very popular sport. In fact, we're starting to see women teams develop, too, in wrestling. I'd like to see more wrestling teams, but we're seeing some cuts. Schools are making decisions about which sports they want to support, and wrestling, at least in the last few years, has not been at the top of that list. It's hard to explain, but I don't think it has anything to do with Title IX.
You've mentioned that although some universities and colleges have had to cut teams, others have found themselves able to add teams. What do you expect along those lines as we get into the next year and the year after that?
Well, I think the financial milieu in which they play is going to become more difficult, not less. For the vast majority of our college sporting teams, they're integrated into the budgeting of the entire university. As the university feels pressured financially, the athletic programs will also. So we will see some pressure for cutting teams, but we'll also see some pressure, I think, on the support troops. We may see some postponement of stadium build-out. So I expect over the next year we're going to see all those things happen.
Miles Brand is the president of the NCAA. Mr. Brand, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's my pleasure.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. On last week's program, Tim Kirkjian and I spoke about the drop in attendance in many Major League Baseball parks. In response, Linda Fletcher, who hears Only a Game on WCPN in Cleveland, emailed to mention a program the Indians have introduced called Fill the House for Charity Wednesday. The team donates tickets to local charities, then contributes additional money to those charities for each ticket they sell. Ms. Fletcher writes, "This is one answer to your question about what some teams are doing to get people into the stadiums." As resource development manager for the Center for Families and Children in Cleveland, Ms. Fletcher says she's grateful for the innovation. When Charlie Pierce and I discussed last week the election of a former Detroit Pistons point guard to the office of mayor of Detroit, New Hampshire Public Radio listener Chris Landy thought he heard a clunker. "As an old Detroit Pistons fan who lived in Michigan during the 70s, I must tell you that it is David Bing, never, ever Dave Bing," he wrote. But it turns out that it is Dave Bing in this week's Detroit Free Press story about how the new mayor doesn't want to live in the mayor's mansion in Detroit. It's Dave on the Pistons website, too. In that same conversation, Charlie maintained that the Coyotes, the NHL team that formerly played in Phoenix, never got much support. Brian Dahmer, who hears only a game on KSUT in Ignacio, Colorado, begs to differ. "The average attendance was over 13,000, he wrote. "The team failed because they drafted wrong, made bad free agent decisions, and had an inferior coach and a dysfunctional front office. This is not about lack of support." And finally, a couple of weeks ago, we featured a little of the guitar stylings of former New York Yankees center fielder Bernie Williams. Bruce McDonald, a WBUR listener, wrote, "I was looking forward to hearing Mr. Williams' rendition of Take Me Out to the Ball Game, but you talked over it." So here's a little more of it. You can send us your comments on the program via our website, onlyagame.org. You can write us at Only A Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Oops, I talked over Take Me Out to the Ball Game again. I'll stop as soon as I mention that you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Now I'll stop and you can just listen. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And Decorative Museum and Sculpture Park, presenting modern and contemporary sculpture and art on 35 acres, 15 miles from Boston in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Details at decordiva.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's been a tough slog in the Premiership for Newcastle United, nicknamed the Toon. With only 5 wins on the season, Newcastle are hovering close to relegation. The Reverend Glyn Evans, chaplain of St. Andrew's Church in Newcastle, has responded by rewriting the words of several hymns to reflect his support of the local squad. His team's uniforms are black, so for Mr. Evans, "All Things Bright and Beautiful" has become "All Things Black and Beautiful," and "Lord of the Dance" has become "Lord of the Tune." "Unfortunately, Newcastle fans haven't had much joy to sing about this season," the Reverend says. "I'm hoping a bit of divine intervention can pull us out of the relegation zone." Well, yeah, and the odd goal might come in handy as well.
"We're the most united team in all the land."
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, sailors with a family in every port, albeit the same family every time. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce on the line for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Rachel Alexandra is the favorite in today's Preakness. Have you heard any grumbling amongst the old Stallion network that a filly is getting all the attention?
Well, I mean, obviously, the two odd things about this is that she is the primary ride for the jockey who won with Mind That Bird in the Derby a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So that's a switchover. But most of the people I talked to wondered why she didn't run the Derby in the first place.
Mind That Bird went off at 50-1 when he won the Kentucky Derby. Today's odds on that horse are something like 6-1. Is that because jockey Mike Smith, who will be atop Mind That Bird, is just a much better jockey than Calvin Burrell?
No, I think the odds are a little bit silly at this point because this is the shortest of the three races, and this horse isn't built for that.
The Denver Nuggets and Cleveland Cavaliers await their dance partners in the NBA's conference finals. You want to make some picks about who they'll play?
I think Los Angeles is going to somehow manage to stumble through at home and win. I don't have the faintest idea who's going to win Orlando and Boston. That series ceased to make sense by Game 3. I just know that the Celtics didn't want any part of a Game 7 at home or away.
Former NBA star and jazz bassist Wayman Tisdale passed away yesterday at the age of 44. Did you ever get a chance to either see or hear him play?
I saw him play basketball a lot when he was in college and for the Olympic team in 1984. I never saw him in concert, but he was one of the gentlest souls I ever met.
The very exciting NHL playoff series between the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Washington Capitals was billed as the Sidney Crosby versus Alex Ovechkin show. Was it, or did the Penguins just have a more effective supporting cast?
Well, it was right up till Game 7, which landed with a thud in the middle of the league. Basically, what you said is correct. There's a lot more talent on Pittsburgh. Not a lot more, but just enough more talent on Pittsburgh than there was on Washington. I suspect if these teams played a bunch of seven-game series, they would all end up pretty much the same way.
Charlie, the Cincinnati Bengals are in the news this week, and not just because the gridiron artist formerly known as Chad Ochocinco will sport a jersey in 2009, which actually will read Ochocinco. I read it fast because it's only one word on the back of his jersey. Also, an HBO reality series, Hard Knocks, will feature the Bengals. I bet you can't wait to see that one.
Well, that show is an annual creature of cable television. Every team hates it. All teams volunteer for it. It makes no sense. I can't figure out, did they just have a problem with Ochocinco being two words?
That seems to be the case. There's no logic here.
Maybe he should have hyphenated and said his father's name was Ocho and his mother's name was Cinco.
That probably would have done it. The National Football League announced this week that they are considering staging a second regular season game in London in 2010. Commissioner Goodell said he wanted to, quote, feed the passion. Is he talking about the same United Kingdom that I know?
I don't know, but I'll tell you what, he's guaranteed himself two more very upset football coaches because nobody except the league and its marketing department likes these games.
It is fair to say that the teams that go to the UK to play get a bye week the following week, so jet lag shouldn't be too much of a problem.
Yeah, but you know, football coaches, anything, you know, you put the wrong kind of cream in their coffee and they're such creatures of habit, they're liable to burn down the Starbucks.
On Tuesday, the Delaware State Senate approved sports betting, prompting challenges from the NCAA and from the National Football League, which claims the government has overstepped its bounds. Did you find it comforting to know that in addition to providing top-notch sports entertainment, the NFL is now a government watchdog organization?
This is really astonishing. The National Football League is asking the court to declare that the elected Delaware legislature has overstepped its authority over Delaware.
The NFL's conception of its own authority knows no bounds, obviously. There are all sorts of ways to break the NCAA's rules, perhaps none quite as direct as actually paying somebody associated with a player that you want to play basketball for you, which USC coach Tim Floyd allegedly did. The alleged recipient of $1,000 was a handler of O.J. Mayo. Does this story seem unlikely to you?
Well, the amount seems very low, so that makes it very unlikely to me. Even the most losing college basketball coach has a bigger budget for players than that. But the O.J. Mayo situation was a business transaction from start to finish anyway. Why it would shock anybody is surprising to me.
Okay, quiz time. Boston Red Sox manager Terry Francona finds his team is shorthanded late in a game, and he asks outfielder Rocco Baldelli if he can play shortstop. Baldelli prepares for the challenge by A, rushing into the clubhouse to locate a protective cup, B, asking a coach just how it is that one makes a double play, C, saying he'd like to pitch someday, and D, all of the above.
I want to say it's the protective cup answer.
Well, in fact, it's all of the above. I just love the image of a coach trying to explain. Well, first you catch the ball, see, then you shovel it over to the second baseman.
And then we all go to Burger King afterwards.
All right. If you were one of the active Major League Baseball players most thoroughly mired in controversy, say, I don't know, Alex Rodriguez, what former player would you least want coming to your defense?
Former player?
Yeah.
Jose Canseco.
Well, close, because what he got was Pete Rose.
Oh, God.
Pete said Alex Rodriguez should be in the Hall of Fame. What do you think?
With me, said Pete.
That part wasn't in the article, but it's probably there.
But it's implied in everything Pete says.
Former Duke starting guard Greg Paulus will try out for the starting quarterback job at Syracuse. Should he make the team, will legions of Tar Heels fans come to loathe Syracuse?
No, I don't know what the Tar Heel fans will do, but I have a real bad feeling for Greg Paulus. He took enough beating as a point guard at Duke. Wait till he gets behind that Syracuse offensive line.
When minor league pitcher Josh Faiola was assigned to the Lake Erie Crushers, he was a little surprised to learn that he would be housed at a local assisted living facility. You think he was even more surprised to learn that his new digs were cause for envy among some of his teammates?
What, is it quiet life? There's not much to do except concentrate on baseball.
Well, yeah, I mean, frequently minor league players have host families. This is just a little older than the usual host family.
And you can never tell when you know you might need an extra oxygen tank.
Hard games, night games, yeah. And finally, Charlie, Niklas Stoipel wishes to represent his country in the 2012 Olympics, but swimming's international ruling body, FINA, has banned the German lad from competition. What has he done wrong?
He's a synchronized swimmer, and there is no male synchronized swimming, although there was a very funny Saturday Night Live skit about it a few years back.
Maybe that's what he had in mind. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and of course he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Today, the 8 vessels sailing in the around-the-world Volvo Ocean Race will set off from Boston. The boats have traveled from Spain to South Africa, India, Singapore, China, and Brazil before docking in Boston, but they're not done yet, and they're also not alone. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
Wherever it goes, the Volvo Ocean Race brings along a village, almost like a carnival. There are live bands, thrill rides, and of course, plenty of marketing opportunities for the sponsors. There's also the ocean sailing version of the Hammer and Bell Carnival Challenge, except men, women, and children try to impress their loved ones by working winches, just like the ones on the boats, to clock their speed and strength at working with sails.
On your mark.
Here they go.
Get set.
Blair Indine has seen it all before. Blair calls herself a carny, a roadie, and a racer chaser, but she wouldn't choose any other life.
It is a circus, but it's a fun circus because it's a family. It's nice, and you're never alone. I say it's like camp. We sort of eat together, stay together, play together, and it's great fun, and you get to see the world.
This is the second time Blair's followed her husband, David, the pitman for Ericsson 4, around the world in the Volvo Ocean Race. Their son is a bit newer to the lifestyle.
He's 17 months, Oliver. He is a trooper. He's pretty good on the planes these days. He's been on a plane from pretty much day one, so.
Oliver's mom and dad know eventually their son will want to play sports, join a club, or attend his high school prom. But those considerations are still years away.
The school of thought is your child gets to see the world, and that in itself is such a great life experience. And then to be able to have some time to put them in with other kids and learn about where they are and what their dad's doing, it's great.
When Oliver gets a little older, he'll be attending school here in a temporary classroom behind all the attractions, just minutes from his dad on the dock. And if he has any luck at all, his teacher will be Bryony Kent.
Good morning, Alec.
Good morning, Bryony.
Good morning, Edward.
Good morning, Bryony.
Bryony's full-time job is to teach the children of the sailors, media people, and shore crew of the Volvo Ocean Race. Her students range in age from 4 to 13 and come from 10 different countries. While most of them speak at least some English, phonics class can be a challenge.
What would you say, Alex? Because you're from Australia. How would you say this sound?
E. E.
F. For the F, do you remember what we did? Because we crack open the egg. So we take the egg and we go, eh, 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 eh.
Bryony pantomimes breaking an egg to help the children remember that S sound. For the letter T, she waves her hands back and forth while holding an imaginary tennis racket. She says associating sounds with actions is a big help when teaching a classroom full of kids who don't agree on how to say the word egg.
Especially with the children from New Zealand and Australia, the way they pronounce an E or an E is quite different to how I would. So especially with the I and the E, we often get confused when we're writing. So I have to try and put my twang on and try and get the sound across to them. And also I've had a lot of the parents coming in saying, my son's speaking with an English accent.
The younger kids follow a curriculum designed by Bryony, while the older ones bring along assignments from their schools back home. Bryony Kent is the only qualified teacher, but the Volvo School employs one tutor for every 5 or 6 students. The aim is to keep kids from falling too far behind while they're traveling around the world, but Bryony says that's never been a problem.
It's not often that you can get to the age of 6 and say list all the countries you've been to and actually know where they are in the world. Pretty amazing.
10-year-old Isabella enjoys long airplane flights because she gets to watch movies for hours and no one bugs her to do something more productive. The young Kiwi has only been in the U.S. for a week and a half, but she's pretty sure she can already name all 50 states. And she's even more confident when rattling off the places she's been since this race began.
Alicante, Cape Town, India, Singapore, China, then Rio, and now we're here. I've been traveling ever since I was 5 months, so I'm pretty used to it.
4-year-old Finn is not quite so sure of all the places he's been in his young life.
I don't remember New Zealand. Yeah. I don't know what else other countries I've been to. I've been to Sweden.
To Sweden. And where are you now?
Africa.
With help from Bryony, Finn eventually remembers that he went to Disney World last week, and Disney World is in America, though Finn points out that America and Africa kind of sound alike. Finn's dad, Brad Jackson, is the watch captain on Ericsson 4. He says he and his wife, a former flight attendant, always meant to settle down and have kids, but somewhere along the way, they had Finn and his 2 older brothers without ever settling down.
It's a bit of a compromise, you know. They travel around, they meet lots of people, they learn different languages. But obviously they miss out on the routine and the structure that living at home has. We try and do what we can to make their life normal, and it's not always easy, and it's not going to be, but at the moment it seems to be working okay.
Jackson seems resigned to giving up this life eventually, but for now, 7 months into a nearly 9-month race, he and his family are just looking forward to a break.
You know, we've got a new house at home that, you know, we've been away for 2 years more or less, and we've never lived in this house. Kids are really looking forward to that. It backs onto their school they're going to go to, and it's got a swimming pool. But then I know we'll get home, and after a couple of months we'll be like, okay, what are we going to do now?
Puma skipper Ken Reed, his wife Kathy, and their 12-year-old daughter Tori make those decisions together. Or at least that's how they decided to put their lives in Rhode Island on hold and join the Volvo Ocean Race.
We did. We voted, and it was early on it was 2-1 against, and then it became 2-1-4, and Tori was clearly the vote that was the hardest to capture. But she came around. I think she's right. I think she's really glad she did it.
That original yes vote came not from Ken Reed, but from his wife, Kathy. She's been married to Ken for nearly 20 years now, but she hasn't yet gotten tired of circling the globe.
I love to travel, and with Tori being 12 and in sixth grade, I thought it was the perfect time for her to go and see the world. She's at the age where she's going to remember it and to experience different cultures, different foods, just everything. It's been just an amazing opportunity, you know, and it's something I hope you never forget.
I don't think anybody could forget this.
Tori might not ever forget this experience, but like young Finn, she does sometimes forget where she's at in the world.
I get confused easily. Then you start speaking Spanish in India and in South Africa, and then suddenly you have no idea where you are and start speaking a ton of different languages.
Kathy says she'll be sad when the race is over. Tori's feelings are a bit more mixed. But Ken Reed can't wait for it all to end, especially the emotional roller coaster of a race that stops and starts in 10 different ports.
There's two very, well, distinctly different emotions. When you leave, it's the worst part of the race. Leaving your family on the dock, knowing you're going off to sea, going off kind of throwing yourself in harm's way, it's a really tough time for everybody. Kids are crying, wives are crying, guys are trying not to cry in front of their peers. And it's really hard. And it happens very often. I mean, we're going to do it 10 different times. Those are 10 miserable days. But on the other hand, the best day by far is arrival day. That part is fantastic. That hug, those hugs are the best hugs. Best hugs going.
Today is the day Ken has been dreading since his boat arrived in Boston 3 weeks ago. The sailors will say goodbye to their wives and children on the dock and set sail for Galway, Ireland. If winds and currents cooperate, the families will reunite on the other side of the Atlantic in about a week. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Josh Levin Schurz. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Karen Given's Volvo Ocean Race School photos or our UVM baseball photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from Tori Reed, who admits to her sailor dad that she and her mom track the Volvo Ocean Race by a computer.
If you're in third, she freaks out.
Third? This is pressure I didn't even know.
Well, I'm calm with it. It's just Mom.
Sounds like Mom is a bit of a front runner. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.